This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Later in the hour, an investigation into safety breaches at the nation's national nuclear weapons laboratories. But first, if you have an upcoming surgery, you may not want to hear this. Hospitals sometimes schedule surgeons for overlapping surgeries, like two at a time. But it's not as bad as it sounds. The primary surgeon finishes the most crucial or difficult part and then hands off the rest, maybe just the closing of the incision, to someone qualified to do it. Still, it's something that patients often don't know about, and maybe they should. Here to explain this, plus other selected short subjects in science, is Amy Nordrum, associate editor at the IEEE Spectrum. Welcome back. Always good to see you.
Thanks, Ira.
Well, let's talk about these overlapping surgeries. They go on all the time?
This is a really common practice in medicine, and generally it's thought of as ethically okay by large medical associations and the surgeons who are doing it. So the important distinction here is that the critical portion of the surgery is not overlapping. That's what's called a concurrent surgery, if you double book a surgery for the exact same time, and that is typically not allowed throughout the medical profession. But these overlapping surgeries are really pretty common, but a couple of recent investigations by the Boston Globe and the Seattle Times have brought this practice to light and started to raise some questions about it. We really haven't done a lot of studies on it, so it's not really clear what this means for patient safety. And certainly most patients who are scheduled for these overlapping surgeries aren't even aware that this is happening.
Can you ask? I want my doctor in the hallway.
Yes, you absolutely can. I mean, it's definitely something to be aware of. This week, there was an editorial published in the medical journal JAMA, and it was talking about the fact that there needs to be a lot more transparency and disclosure and perhaps even, you know, consent forms around the fact that some patients may prefer to wait a little bit longer for surgery if it means that they don't have to be part of an overlapping one, if they're not comfortable with the practice itself.
As long as they're circling the right area with a Sharpie, I'm good with that.
That's what really matters.
That's what matters. Let's move on to a wildlife news. Can you guess what that is? I'm sure you could. That's a woodpecker.
Not quite.
No?
But close.
No, what is it?
It is a bird. It's a bird called the palm cockatoo, also called the palmy. This is a bird found in northern Queensland in Australia. And that strange tapping you hear is a sound that it's created by fashioning its own drumsticks, essentially, out of twigs that it strips of the leaves and bites down to size, and then also hardened seed pods. It uses these instruments, these musical instruments, basically, to drum on tree trunks and branches as part of a mating ritual around this time of year.
Is any dancing, any relationship to that dancing cockatoo we've seen viral on YouTube?
Yes, that dancing cockatoo is named Snowball, and
it has
an impeccable sense of rhythm. And what's really impressive about these palm cockatoos is a lot of animals have shown proclivity for rhythm. So we know that, you know, birds in their songs and whales in their songs as well can have a certain rhythm to their music and their vocalizations. But these palm cockatoos are doing something really different. I mean, they're actually shaping a musical tool. They're actually creating a physical instrument that they're then using to create the sound and the song. Their songs also have particular musical styles. So these male cockatoos performing the mating rituals, you know, some of them will drum very slowly and consistently, and then others will drum, you know, much faster and have a lot of different variants in their songs that they're playing.
Are they just trying to get discovered, or is this a mating thing, or what?
Yeah, so this is usually performed in front of a female during the mating period. So this is one part of their very extravagant mating ritual. They also do things like, you know, flare up this very high crest on top of their heads, and they flash these bright red patches on their cheeks. So it's part of this whole display that they're going for here.
I wonder if you could get one at home to do it. We'll find out from our listeners.
Actually, the ones in captivity do not do this. And even palm cockatoos found elsewhere in the world do not. It's only in this one particular place. It's a very, very local behavior for this one population in Queensland.
Wow. Let's move on to another story you wrote this week, that there's a growing market for AI, artificial intelligence, in hedge fund management.
Wow. That's right.
Sounds spooky.
Well, hedge funds are sort of these notorious Wall Street entities, and they're constantly trying to find, you know, ways to make better returns for their investors. And historically, what they've done is they've relied on people, so fund managers, and their own judgment and experience to, you know, make the investment calls and invest billions of dollars. But increasingly, you know, people have a problem, which is that they make mistakes and they're full of biases and emotions. And fund managers, you know, maybe they'll be hot for a while, but then, you know, their investments will kind of cool off and they're not so reliable. So what hedge funds are doing now is they're trying to move more toward quantitative methods. They're trying to use data analytics, machine learning, to create systems that can basically crunch market data, kind of improve their strategy over time automatically, and then learn how to invest money for the best future returns, better than humans could do on their own.
So they take sort of the drama out of it, or the human element that, I got a hunch about something is...
That's right. All the messiness that we have as humans that are trying to make decisions, especially around finances. There's been a lot of research on this, actually. And so the idea is that maybe machines could do it better.
Yeah.
There's one fund called Quantopian that's actually crowdsourcing investment algorithms. And you can write one and submit it. And if they like it, they'll put money into it. These are pretty new experiments, so we're not really sure how they're going to fare. But there's a lot of investors that are hoping they'll provide better returns.
Mine's still under the mattress. Finally, there's a hefty fine for Google this week. I mean, relatively speaking, hefty.
Actually, yeah, I mean, it's a really big one. It's the $2.7 billion. This was handed down by the European Commission. And the problem here is really a pretty simple feature that Google has implemented. We're probably all familiar with it. It's when you search for a product, there's a bar of results that will pop up at the top of your Google search results before the text. And it's just a little collection of boxes. And it has, a picture of the product. And it has maybe some ratings and some price information. And this is what Google is pulling from its Google shopping results. Well, the European Commission has said that this is an antitrust violation because Google is essentially using its dominance in one market as a search engine to promote one of its other products and services, which is its shopping, over those of its competitors. So they're instructing Google to change the way it displays its search results within 90 days, or they could impose additional fines on the company.
What's the fine? How much is the fine?
Well, the initial fine is $2.7 billion, and then there could be additional fines after that.
What's it, a $100 billion company? It's like cost of doing business for Google.
I mean, in some sense, last year I think their revenues is around $90 billion. Yeah. It's a meaningful chunk to the company. We'll have to see how they react. They're considering an appeal right now.
Hmm. So we could see what our personalized assistant services turn into.
That's right. Stay tuned.
Stay tuned. Amy, always great to have you.
Thanks, Ira.
Have a happy 4th of July.
You too.
Amy Nordstrom, Associate Editor at the IEEE Spectrum. And now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side, and today's story is about the fast-moving solar power revolution going on in California. It's the country's number one solar-producing state, with solar farms not just out in the desert, but all up and down the state's agricultural center, too, the Central Valley, as they call it out there. And one day this spring, 40% of all the energy pumping into the grid during midday was from solar. 40%. But that solar surplus comes with a not-so-bright side. Here to talk about the good and the bad is Ivan Penn, energy reporter at the LA Times. His investigation into California's solar energy market can be found at sciencefriday.com/solar. He joins us by Skype. Welcome, Ivan.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So you have all this clean energy, but that's the good news, right?
That is the good news. We've had tremendous growth in clean energy, solar and wind in particular. Renewables now make up about 27% of California's energy mix.
That's pretty, and it's growing all the time.
It is. If you consider that, and nationally even, solar made up about 39% of all of the capacity that was added. And for California, that means now solar is about 13 to 14%, both utility and rooftop solar.
That's amazing. So how could this have a bad side?
Well, the trouble is that we don't have a clear policy to manage all the renewables that we're adding to the grid. And the state is working on it. But what that has done is led to us paying other states to take our excess solar power.
They don't get it. They don't get it for free. They actually, you pay them.
Well, that's right. Well, it can be free, but it's sort of your basic economics here. If they don't need it, but we need to get rid of it, then we might have to actually pay them to take it.
Wow. So where are we headed? What needs to change? Do we have to modify the grid, batteries? What's your take on all of this?
Well, the Holy Grail is viewed as storage, and that can come in a few different forms, but batteries, of course, is what we're looking at. Tesla, and then their major competitor, Sun and Inc. And getting that where it needs to be, both residentially and on the utility scale, that has been a focal point.
And the cost then of solar power is always coming down, isn't it?
It has over the last, if you think back just a decade ago, solar was a blip on the screen, but now the price has dropped so much that we've gone from less than 1% in 2010 in California as far as solar to where, as I mentioned, it's now 13 to 14%.
And the batteries are key to all of this because you can store it up. I understand that there's a special deal in Arizona linking batteries and solar power in a plant.
We saw a historically low price with the Tucson Electric Power and a solar and battery combination. So you're seeing batteries also drop in price. And you may see in the next 2 or 3 years along the same lines as we've seen with solar.
Mm-hmm. So what is that? But won't cheap natural gas hurt that?
Well, so natural gas, you know, obviously the fracking boom brought natural gas in lower than coal, and that's been a big challenge for coal. But what you've seen with the solar and the battery combination in Arizona is a price that was actually lower than natural gas.
Lower than natural gas? You can do a battery, solar combination with power plant that brings it in lower than natural gas. That's a game changer, it sounds like.
It has stunned the industry that kind of price could come in because batteries were viewed as still too expensive, but that seems to be changing.
Ivan Penn, energy reporter at the LA Times. You can follow him at sciencefriday.com/solar. Thanks for taking time. Good holiday to you, Ivan. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the U.S. weapons labs and actions that expose scientists to radiation. After this break, stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. The U.S. hasn't deployed a nuclear bomb since it dropped the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But the U.S. arsenal of over 4,000 nuclear warheads still has to be maintained. And caring for those warheads, checking on them, replacing their parts, well, it's dangerous work because, after all, this is radioactive material. So you might assume that facilities like Los Alamos National Laboratory, where plutonium for the warheads is handled, would be extra cautious. But an investigation by the Center for Public Integrity revealed several critical safety accidents that have crippled production at Los Alamos and put scientists and researchers in contact with radioactive materials. We're going to dig into that investigation and what they found with my guest, Jeffrey Smith, managing editor for the Center for Public Integrity. Welcome to Science Friday.
Welcome, Ira. Thanks.
So let's talk about this first. The U.S. isn't making any new weapons, so what kind of work is being done at Los Alamos?
So Los Alamos does two things that nobody else does, and the entire nuclear weapons complex, which includes about 10 facilities, they make pits, the cores of nuclear warheads, and they test them to make sure that they're aging gracefully and not degrading in some way while they're deployed on weapons.
Tell us about the incident that started your investigation into the safety issues at Los Alamos.
So in 2011, a couple of technicians, a photographer, decided to position some plutonium rods in a so-called glove box on top of a glove box, which used to control some of the hazards. And they put them 8 rods of plutonium closer together than they were supposed to.
And what's the danger in that?
So the danger is that, you know, this is man-made material. It's meant to be unstable. It was designed to be unstable. That's where you get the explosive whack of a nuclear explosion. Mm-hmm. So in this case, if you put too much plutonium together, some of the neutrons that are emitted constantly by the plutonium contain other atoms and cause those atoms to split, provoking other neutrons to fly off and hit other atoms, and it produces a nuclear chain reaction.
Mm-hmm. And so there's not a bomb is not going to blow off.
No, it's not an explosion, but it's a burst of radiation that basically can kill everybody in the room.
Mm-hmm. We asked for a comment from them, and we've got a statement that said, with regard to the story, it's simply not true, the rods about going critical. In fact, the conditions did not exist to support a critical chain reaction. Factors such as amount and shape, among others, made that virtually impossible.
So it's interesting that they said that. I could just cite the Department of Energy's account of this. They said the mass of the plutonium, this was a report in December 2012, it said the mass of the plutonium in the new location had significantly exceeded the posted criticality safety limit. Hmm. And they also said the government report also said that it was determined that no hazard existed only after the rods had been moved back into their original places. And at that point, the room was released for normal operations. So mm-hmm. you have Los Alamos's account of what happened, and then you have the accounts of others.
So why did the lab then shut down shortly?
So the account that we were given was that many of the people that worked there on criticality safety, this task of keeping plutonium from causing a nuclear chain reaction. Many of those people left. They were disgruntled. They thought they were disrespected by the management. They thought that the safety concerns that they had expressed were not being taken seriously. And when this was noticed in Washington, an official in Washington that oversees this laboratory's work called up and said, you need to shut this lab.
Is there any issue with getting replacements for them, younger people? I'm imagining these are more of the senior members who decided to leave.
Yeah, this is a difficult profession to be in. And we've been told by people who do this kind of work that it takes about 5 years to become proficient and on top of some training. And so it's when everybody left Los Alamos, they were down to one person.
One person.
In 2013, when it was shut. And they needed about 30.
And so do you know now how many they might have?
So this is an issue in contention. I mean, in February, an oversight group that works for Congress or reports to Congress said that they needed 27 fully qualified criticality specialists. And they said that the laboratory has 10. Now, the laboratory has since said that it has more than 10. But I think that these are not certified, qualified. Mm-hmm. They haven't been through all the professional training and certification process that would allow them to do this work.
In fact, Los Alamos, when we asked them, although they declined to come on the program, they sent us a few statements. And they said, in fact, the current authorized level is actually 25. And that is being met on site with 20 full-time employees and 5 subcontractors.
Yeah. The issue is whether these are certified and qualified employees. And in June, the associate administrator for safety at the National Nuclear Security Administration said at a public event in Santa Fe that the lab had not met their requirement. His exact wording were, they're not where we need them to be.
It seems like some of the safety lapses were in response to production demands from the federal government. What kind of expectations does the DOE place on Los Alamos?
So it's not just Los Alamos. We found this to be a recurrent problem across the nuclear weapons complex, that in many cases the reports that the government did on safety lapses cited the overarching danger of too much emphasis on production. Hmm. And in this case, it would have been a requirement that they test a certain number of these plutonium parts for nuclear warheads under a deadline, or that they produce new ones. Congress has imposed a deadline. It says that you have to, within the next 10 years, you have to be prepared to start making between 30 and 80 plutonium pits per year.
Right.
It's a messy, complex process, and they haven't been doing it.
So is your research showing that that the government is sort of covering up the safety problems at these labs?
Well, it's not our conclusion to draw, but the people that we spoke to said that they were frustrated that the government had not been more transparent about these problems.
You know, I'm thinking, and I'm old enough to remember this, I'm thinking of the Karen Silkwood incident back in the 1970s. You know, where she was killed in a car accident on her way to meeting with a reporter for the New York Times.
Well, there's no hint of anything like that here.
Yeah.
But the truth is that the nuclear weapons laboratories are used to operating under a shroud of secrecy that's not so easy to pierce. With the skill of my great reporters, Patrick Malone mm-hmm. and Peter Carey, that we were able to get to the bottom of this.
Getting back to those pits, why do they need to make them if no one's using them?
So the pits, our new pits are needed if they want to develop a new warhead.
Yeah.
And they also have a lot of pits that are in the field, and they want to make sure that they're not misbehaving in some way. These are unstable materials that the pits are made of and that they're surrounded by. They don't want to be surprised. They want to make sure that these bombs can work. Somebody compared it to what you would do to test a car.
Yeah.
If you stored it for decades, you'd want to be sure that when you turned the key and had to drive down the road suddenly that it would still work.
So we have these nuclear warheads, but we can't test them to know if they're working or not.
Yes. So this testing that was done in this laboratory that's mm-hmm. been shuttered is meant to replace the underground nuclear testing, which was stopped. So it's a more passive type of test, and they do a lot of other related testing, computer simulation work, and other analysis that supports this. But it's all meant to take the place of underground testing.
Is this a unique event to Los Alamos, or what about the other sites like Sandia?
So we studied 60 safety lapses over the last decade at 10 different facilities, and we found that the safety incident rate was not declining as it is at basically heavy industrial workplaces across America, and it may be increasing. And the numbers were rising a lot in 2015, 2016. They were a lot higher than they were in 2013.
Mm-hmm. So, and the government partners with private companies in all of these facilities.
Yeah, so this is a key fact. You'd think that these are nuclear weapons. They must be made by the government for the government's use. But in fact, the laboratories are government-owned but managed by private contractors. All their expenses are paid by the government, and then they make a profit on top of that.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of penalties can the government give them if they're...
So the government can remove their access to the management contract. They can get a new contractor to do it, but they rarely do that. The average tenure of a contractor in the Department of Energy is 17 years, so it's not a trigger they pull very often. And they can also ding them with safety fines, but we found that the overwhelming number of safety fines in the last decade has been, mm-hmm. In each case, they proposed a fine and then reduced it.
Mm-hmm. I want to bring on another guest. David Oversky is president of Decision Factors Incorporated, which is a private contractor that provided consultation to the government on nuclear weapons. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
You've read this CPI series that we're talking about, and more importantly, you've worked at nuclear weapons labs as a private contractor. Were you surprised by the safety incidents this investigation uncovered?
Partially. There are incidences that occur, but I think some of the tone of the reporting implies that there's lack of will and intent on the part of the employees to operate safely. And my experience has been that's not really the case.
And from your experience in the private sector, is there a better way to respond to safety accidents and incidents involving radioactive materials or avoid them altogether?
Yes, there is a much better way. I have been for a number of years advocating that a significant part of the problem and a part of the cost that the Department of Energy and NNSA in particular is incurring is owed to the self-regulation that the DOE has. And if the Department of Energy would allow outside parties, meaning OSHA and EPA and the NRC, to regulate, come in and regulate the actions at the department sites, they would be better served and the employees would be better served as well.
And is there any lab in your experience in the private sector that's doing this well?
There is an organization, not in the U.S. It's the Atomic Weapons Establishment in the U.K., and it provides the same services to the U.K. government that the eight sites in the NNSA provide to the U.S., and that is completely regulated by the public entity in the U.K.
Jeff Smith, your reaction.
So it is unusual that, when the Occupational Safety and Health Administration Act was written into law, only two government institutions were exempted from its jurisdiction, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the Department of Energy. So they have been self-regulating, and it raises questions about whether they get enough independent voice, enough of an independent voice into the process.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. In case you just joined us, we're talking about weapons research at Los Alamos and other laboratories and how dangerous that could be. David, is there any way for these national labs to get back on track?
Yes. I think one of the let me make one other comment here to clarify something that has been said, and it's alluded to the fact that people feel that the problem is the commercial contractors that are operating the laboratories, and that really isn't necessarily the case. The management of the laboratories may have some individuals that come from the commercial sector, but a number of the people, including senior members of the laboratory, and Los Alamos is an example of one, and also the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, those individuals have worked in these laboratories or sister laboratories their entire professional career. So the management companies that come in are supposed to bring some oversight and also management skills that make the laboratories operate better, but it's not like these people are coming in from commercial industry and then running the lab. In fact, maybe the lab would be better if there were more commercial people installed in the management locations at these places.
Is that your recommendation for how to get this back on track?
That's one of them. So I would encourage more of the industrial people to be actually within the organization, not just at the upper management level,
okay,
but propagated throughout the delivery part of the organization. So
Jeff?
That would be one thing. The second thing is, and this I think is more relevant, the Department of Energy, even if they're going to be self-regulated, they should have an organization, like we're talking about these criticality specialists. They should be criticality specialists, not just at Los Alamos, but a group that provides that service for Livermore, Los Alamos, the Nevada Test Site, Sandia, Y-12, Pantex, across the entire complex. That is the way that you keep expertise within the entire organization and make it available uniformly to every single operating entity so that you apply the same rules and procedures at all locations. And that is currently not the situation at these DOE sites.
All right, we're getting out of time, so I want to ask Jeff for a comment.
So two points quickly. One is that Charlie McMillan, who runs the Los Alamos Laboratory and has presided over this period in which Los Alamos has been cited repeatedly for safety lapses, is a nuclear physicist and a weapons designer, but he is also an officer in the corporation that runs Los Alamos. His salary, we don't know exactly what his what portion of his compensation is salary and what portion is other forms of remuneration, but it's over $1 million a year.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea is that the critics of this setup say that his incentives are can be more financial than scientific.
All right, we're going to leave it there, and I want to thank both of you for taking time to be with us today. Jeff Smith, Managing Editor for the Center for Public Integrity, and David Oversky, who is the President of Decision Factors Incorporated, a private contractor who provided consultation to the government on nuclear weapons. And you can check out the five-article series from the Center for Public Integrity at sciencefriday.com/safety. After the break, we're going to take a ride with a researcher who tracks polar bears out on the Arctic ice to monitor how the bears are holding up. We'll be taking your polar bear questions, so stay with us. You can ask those questions now. Our number is 844-724-8255. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. The polar regions of the Earth are warming at a faster rate than any other. In the Arctic, patches of sea ice are getting smaller, and the ice sheet is breaking away in chunks in some places. And while the ultimate consequences of the rapid melt to wildlife is still unknown, one of the animals that is already being affected is the polar bear, the iconic polar bear. There are 19 distinct populations of polar bears living in the Arctic, and monitoring how these bears are holding up, you can imagine what a challenge that is. How do they survive on the barren ice, and how do you get up close to look at them and find out? Well, that's the subject of our latest video that's part of our Breakthrough Portraits of Women in Science series, and here to talk about it are our video producer, Luke Raskin. Hi, Luke. And Karen Rode, a wildlife biologist with the U.S. Geological Survey. She's based out in Portland. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Karen, you and Luke went out to the Chukchi Sea. Did I get that right? Which is
That's correct.
It's a remote part of Alaska. Can you describe this area? What does it look like out there?
Well, so the Chukchi Sea is an area between northwest coast of Alaska and the eastern coast of Russia. And the time of year that Luke and I went out is March and April. And at that time of year, it's mostly covered with sea ice. And, sea ice isn't really a flat pancake. There's currents and wind that create openings in the ice. So there's some areas of open water, and there's also areas that the ice comes together that form pressure ridges, so kind of rumbly ice. So it's actually a pretty dynamic landscape.
Mm-hmm. And Luke, you had to do some pretty intense training before you made that trip, right?
Yeah, that's true. In order to actually go out over the Chukchi Sea, you have to take a helicopter or an airplane. But in this case, we took a helicopter. And as part of the training to go out there, I had to take a dunker course, basically an underwater egress course where they flip you upside down and simulate a helicopter crash. It was it was pretty intense. Not something I want to go through again, but definitely confidence boosting when you're in a helicopter flying over the ocean.
But I'll bet your first sight of the ice out there made it all worthwhile. What was that like?
Absolutely. I mean, when you're out there and you're filming and you're just staring out at just endless, ice as far as you can see, it's beautiful in its starkness. It's just sky and ice. And it just sticks with you in your head. And of course, at the entire time you're looking down for polar bears, and technically you shouldn't be looking for polar bears, you should be looking for polar bear tracks, which are in the location where we were numerous. It was pretty incredible to be looking down and just seeing all these tracks that would suddenly meet up with other tracks. So I was expecting they would find one set of tracks and eventually you'd find a bear, but instead you'd see one set of tracks and they would zigzag back and forth, and meanwhile you're getting completely nauseated because the helicopter's swirling, and then they zig back the other way, and then you run into another set of tracks, and then are those the first set of tracks, or is that a new set of tracks? Oh wait, now there's a third set of tracks, and the entire time you're trying to figure out which way you're going, and you're just hoping one of these tracks will lead onto a bear.
Dr. O, as Luke said, the ice is white, the polar bears are white. How do you scout a polar bear from the air?
It's very hard to just see a polar bear itself. I mean, as Luke described, we're mostly tracking, and that's how we find the majority of the bears. But tracking conditions vary. So, you can go out there, and if the ice has been stable, meaning that there hasn't been any wind recently and no new snowfall, then it's like Luke described, which is there's tracks everywhere, and you're trying to determine, is that a week old? Is that a day old? Should we follow them? Will it lead us to a bear?
Hmm. And do you have to just use your judgment from past experience to know what to do in these cases?
Yeah, I mean, we often use the strategy of landing. You can actually look at the the track closer and get a sense for how hard it is, because if it's been from the day before, it will harden and the snow inside the track won't be soft, and you'll have at least a better idea of whether it's been in the past 24 hours or not. So there's some strategies you can use to try to figure out if it's how new it is.
Yeah, but it feels like when you're out there and you see all these tracks, it feels like there's a bear party going on and you just haven't been invited to it. Like, you just see so many of them and you're like, where are they? They've got to be here. We know they're out there.
Karen, you've been going out for years. Does this ever get old? I mean, are you getting too jaded now? Yeah.
I don't think so. I mean, because it's always a challenge and it seems like it's somehow different every time, you know, just when you think you're really good at finding bears and making it all happen, then you have an unusual set of circumstances. We often come across really something interesting and unique every year as well.
So Luke, what was it like your first time?
Seeing the bear?
Yes.
First bear that we, you know, when they first spotted the bear, I couldn't see it at all. It took me at least a minute to be like, okay, oh, there's the bear. And then, of course, it had a big number on its back. And I'm like, what? Why is there a big number on this bear's back? And I asked, and they were like, well, we caught that bear 2 weeks ago. And I was like, oh, no, we're not going to be able to capture this bear, and we're not going to be able to film that. I mean, that's a really critical component of the research, is that they don't want to catch a bear again, and they don't want to harass a bear again, and they don't want to be near the bear that they've already caught. But it was a big male, and I remember looking down at it being like, oh, no. It was a mixture of, like, that's exciting, and also, oh, drat.
The feeling of the bear must be mutual. Our number is 844-724-8255, 844-SCI-TALK, if you'd like to talk about tracking the bear. And also, I noticed in the video, and it's a great video, it's up there on our website, you hover over the bear, Karen, and then you go for a shot to send a dart into it.
Yeah, so you're hovering over the bear. The bear is moving, and so you're moving forward with the bear. And trying to get directly above it so that you shoot the tranquilizer straight down into the muscle.
How close, Luke? You must have been a little weirded out by how close you are to a bear.
I mean,
bear.
If you were riding the bear, you could probably grab onto the helicopter.
Is
were really
close?
Low. Yeah, they're right above the bear, and they have to do that in order to get the dart right on it and put it in the right position. It's pretty dramatic.
And then once the bear, then you must land, right, Dr. Rhodes? You land, and then what do you do?
Yeah, so, you know, usually it takes about 5 minutes for the bear to go to sleep, and then you land, and the very first thing we do is check the bear, make sure it's in a good position and comfortable. And then we start collecting data, so taking measurements and samples.
Like what? Of what kind of samples?
Blood can tell you a lot about an animal, you know, about its health. So from blood, we can identify what type of diet it has, whether it's eaten recently, what pathogens it's exposed to, and what contaminants it's exposed to. We collect hair, which gives a lot of the same information, but over a longer or different time period. And we collect a small fat biopsy, which also can tell us information about what the bear's eaten a bit more specifically than we can get with tissues like blood and hair.
Mm-hmm. Hair, I guess the hair can tell you a lot of stuff about the bear.
Yeah, like I said, it gives a longer time frame and a different time frame, because what's in that hair is primarily when it's grown, and it's grown at a different time of year than when we capture. And so if we want to know what an animal has been exposed to other than during the time frame, really recent time frame before when we caught it, hair is a good tissue to use.
Now I learned from watching the video that polar bears switch between living on the sea ice and on the land. What are some of the stresses that come with this dual lifestyle?
Well, I should clarify a little bit about that. So, you know, you mentioned in the introduction that there's 19 populations, and there are populations that have always made that switch, but those are actually a minority. So those are mostly populations in eastern Canada, where the environment becomes completely ice-free in the summertime, and those bears have always come on land. But all the rest of the polar bear population, so the majority of them, have typically not used land except for denning. And denning in polar bears only occurs by pregnant females. Mm. So not all sex and age classes like you see in other bears. So it's really in more recent years that bears have started to summer more on land in a lot of these other populations than they have in the past.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of the stresses? What is global warming and the melting sea ice doing to the bear population?
Well, again, you've got a lot of diversity across the polar bear's range. So it can be challenging at times to generalize what the response mm-hmm. is, because some populations have seen dramatic sea ice loss, such as the polar bear population in the Chukchi and the Beaufort Seas. But other places have seen very little sea ice loss. And then you have differences in the ecology of these systems. So there's variability, but some of the general responses across populations are the increased land use. More bears coming on shore than have in the past and staying there longer. And when they're on shore, they typically are losing weight because they are eating minimally or not eating at all. So, for example, in the Chukchi Sea, we know from activity sensors and also observations that 90% of the time a bear on shore is just resting. So they're not trying to feed on the foods that are on land. They tend to be relatively poor resources on land in Arctic terrestrial environments.
Mm-hmm. You're comparing this Chukchi population of polar bears to a neighboring group in the Beaufort Sea. What differences are you seeing between them?
Yeah, it's interesting. So the Beaufort Sea ranges between the north coast of Alaska and western Canada. And that population has experienced declines in body condition, cub survival, and recently there's been a pretty significant population decline in abundance. But the Chukchi Sea bears so far, comparing condition and cub survival since the 1980s to kind of the current data we're collecting, suggest that the bears there have stayed in pretty good condition. They're still recruiting cubs into the population. So pretty different responses to significant sea ice loss that's occurred in both of those areas.
Mm-hmm. 844-724-8255 is our number. Why don't these Beaufort bears sort of just migrate over to the more productive Chukchi area?
Well, you know, that's the question that we're going to look at a bit. And anecdotally, there's definitely bears that are in Western Canada that have been shown to go over to Wrangell Island, which is in the Chukchi Sea. There hasn't been a study done yet to look at migratory patterns, but certainly some bears may be coming into the Chukchi Sea more than they have in the past.
Mm-hmm. Let me just remind everybody that this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking about polar bears and the new polar bear video up there. It's our breakthrough video, Portraits of Women in Science series. And it's done by our video producer, Luke Graskin. Also with us is Karen Rode, wildlife biologist for the U.S. Geological Survey. You know, we have a bunch of tweets and phone calls asking all the same thing. It doesn't happen a lot, but the people are, you know, they're very creative here. And they ask, can thermal imaging cameras be used to find the polar bears?
There are some efforts to do that now, and including in the Chukchi Sea, there's been some recent work to look at thermal imagery and try to validate how well it can identify polar bears on the sea ice. So there is some work along those lines to try to use that technique. You know, one of the challenges with that, though, to keep in mind is in places like the Chukchi Sea, the bears are really spread out over a really large area. So even with that technology, you might be able to identify bears, but you're going to have to fly a big area to try to find one. So it may help a little bit in identifying them, but I think tracking actually still works pretty well.
Mm-hmm. What is the with the sea ice in particular? And you're saying that the loss of the polar bears is not consistent over all areas, and I understand you've said that. But where it is a problem, what is the problem with the polar bears' survival in areas? And I've gotten a few calls and tweets about that in areas where they cannot survive. What is the problem there?
What is causing the decline in survival?
Exactly.
Yeah. So one of the primary mechanisms in which we think polar bears are affected by sea ice loss is that they have to have the sea ice to access their primary prey, which are ice-associated seals. So polar bears have a very specialized diet. Typically, 70% of their diet is composed of one or two seal species. And so when there's less ice, you have less of a platform to hunt for seals. And in the populations that have declined, we've seen declines in the condition of animals. And we know in particular that the condition of females is directly related to the size of the cubs she produces, and that the size of a cub is directly related to their survival. So often the pattern goes that as female condition declines, you start to see a decline in recruitment of new individuals into the population. And that seems to be the pattern in these areas where sea ice loss has resulted in population decline.
Mm-hmm. So Luke, tell us a little bit more about the video, what we will see when we go to your website.
Sure. So our video will take you out on the helicopter. You'll get to see us catch one of the bears and all the testing that will go on. You'll also get to see that Karen actually works a little bit with zoo bears and looking at their kind of nutritional requirements and things like that, and how their metabolic rates can inform these wild studies, which I thought was actually kind of fascinating. Another thing that I actually, you know, we touched on it just briefly, was that it's not just the bears that are struggling during the sea ice, it's the bear researchers. While we were out there, the sea ice was starting to break up. And, you know, I think if my memory is correct, the field season actually for this team that was actually was cut short because the sea ice had broken up so much that they actually couldn't find the bears. And I experienced that a lot on that first day out that we were flying around. You could see the sea ice was way more patchy than the second day. We got very lucky because it was a lot more solid.
And there's only one season, one shot at it.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, it's our video. It's up there at sciencefriday.com/polarbear. It's our breakthrough portrait of women in science. And the woman in science we're talking about is Karen Rode. She's a wildlife biologist with the U.S. Geological Survey. And the video is made by our video producer, Luke Raskin. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you.
And have a happy holiday weekend. And if that video's not good enough and you need more stuff for this holiday weekend, please, we have our new podcast, Undiscovered, a new episode this week. And when it comes to genetically modified organisms, this episode is about the debate that, well, it can get very heated.
You're not going to cram something down my throat that I don't want.
Yeah, but what if a GMO could be the solution to an epidemic? On Undiscovered, a scientist tries to convince the island of Martha's Vineyard to fight Lyme disease by bringing thousands of genetically modified mice onto their island.
You got to make a choice one way or another, either you do nothing or do something.
That story is on Undiscovered. Find it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Charles Breckwist is our director, our senior producer, Christopher Intagliata. Our producers are Alexa Lim, Christy Taylor, and Katie Heiler. Rich Kim, our technical director, Sarah Fishman, Jack Horowitz, our engineers at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. Have a great 4th of July weekend and happy 4th. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.